Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz, Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It is Wednesday, January 22nd. We get reaction from lawmakers to the governor's priorities in the State of the State speech. A song about colonialism by Puerto Rican singer Bad Bunny soars in the charts. Why Hawaii gets a nod in the lyrics. We hear how a local farmer is building abundance by growing without soil. Think vertical. What should eaters know about growers? We introduced you to the rock pigeon on today's Manu Minute, and an erupting volcano can bring out the best and worst in people. A new play explores the fiery dynamics of a Big Island family. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The pomp and circumstance of the legislative opening and the State of the State address is behind us. Now the real work begins. HPR's government reporter Ashley Mazua has been busy talking with lawmakers and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, you were down at the Capitol covering the governor's speech yesterday. Not a lot of specifics, but you got a chance to talk to him in the office yesterday.
Yeah, I would say Governor Green thought it was really important to use his speech to tell people what his administration has been able to accomplish over the last 2 years in office versus use it to talk, specific policy going into this legislative session. And he elaborated a lot more on it in a press conference immediately after his remarks. He says that there were three key moments over the last year that have really shaped his approach to governing and the budget this year. One was the acid attack by a man recently released from OCCC on the Chinese woman outside Ala Moana early last year. The second was the Manoa murder-suicide, where economic hardship was one of the reasons that drove the father's actions, and the New Year's Eve explosion that killed at least four people.
Why are we doing the loan forgiveness program help? Because if we do that, then we have a lot more social workers, psychologists, and psychiatrists available possibly to help someone who's coming out of jail and doesn't therefore commit a terrible crime against an individual, or that family of five maybe is here today if we had a psychiatrist that they could have seen, someone safe to talk to. So that's the policy. The policy, as boring as it is to do loan forgiveness for healthcare providers, will provide those providers so that these tragedies don't occur, we hope. Second story, why was that family in such dire straits? Because it is too expensive to live in Hawaii, and he was a professional who felt he still couldn't afford his home. His taxes were too high. The property costs are too high. So you hear me talk in pretty straightforward terms about a tax break of $5.6 billion. That is to prevent families from getting so desperate. That's why we do that and why we're building housing, because the more housing we build, the costs should plateau or come way down if we actually succeed in building the 62,000 houses over the next 10 years. That helps that family.
And then on the fireworks piece, he says it's a problem that the state has, allowed to go on for too long, and now it's just completely out of control. And of course, that tax break he's referring to earlier about the $5.6 billion, that's the income tax break that they passed last session. That's really been kind of a hallmark piece that Governor Green keeps referring back to about how they're trying to address the cost of living in Hawaii. He says it's very likely that the legislature will pass meaningful laws regarding fireworks enforcement this session. He's floated giving out, $300 fines like tickets so that police can actually cite people blowing off fireworks, and then increasing penalties to as high as a Class A felony if fireworks that they're using that are illegal kill somebody. Representative Scott Matayoshi, who chairs the Consumer Protection and Commerce Committee, which will likely be assigned to this fireworks issue, says he's aware of many different fireworks laws kind of coming through the pipeline, and they'll have to see, which one kind of comes to the surface. The other piece of this housing affordability issue is the insurance crisis, and that's something that lawmakers are really keying into this session, as well as Governor Green, but that wasn't something that was directly mentioned in his State of the State address. He says the legislature will also pass some type of law this year to help stabilize the market, like some type of state-provided insurance of last resort that would be probably significantly higher than what a normal policy would be paying, you would pay for, but probably lower than something that's on the rogue market that's not regulated.
Right, but at least you'd be insured.
Exactly. And so that's kind of like a shorter term solution to this problem that they're trying to tackle. But Green's larger issue is the climate resiliency aspect of it, which is driving up these insurance prices. His climate action team estimates that it'll cost $500 million a year to address. And that's why he's again pushing for a climate impact fee of some sort. He says that could mean fees at high areas of use, increasing the transient accommodation tax that's levied on hotels. Or you could do what he's calling the scrape now, which is using interest off of the state's reserve rainy day fund that's ballooned to about $1.5 billion.
So any which way, you can get some money.
He's exactly. He's trying to give them, I think, more options this year opposed to years past. He's kind of just said like, oh, the $25 extra fee on hotels or you know, one-time fee for visitors who come. House Finance Chair Kyle Yamashita says that they need to put money into emergent things like protecting the state's shoreline, but seemed kind of hesitant regarding a new green fee.
That's where I think the priority should be. But in the end, we got to see all the proposals. I think we're looking at all sorts, but at this point in time, what came before us last year, I think would be difficult, but we're looking to see what else is possible.
And then this is what he had to say on opening day about scraping the rainy day fund.
I'm kind of hesitant to touch that because I believe we need to build the reserve up. My concern is we had over a decade since the Lehman Brothers downturn of prosperity, and then we had the pandemic and we had a drop, but the Fed just gave us so much money that it actually spiked and caused inflation. But we are, like I said earlier, we are cyclical, so we have to kind of still be mindful that there may be a downturn or you know, something right now, I believe it's going to be flat for the next few years. But, you know, to your earlier questions, right, we don't know what the feds are going to do.
And, you know, that uncertainty regarding what the federal government is going to do under President Trump's new administration is kind of a looming issue that I think the legislature and Governor Green are very cognizant of. The governor put in an extra $10 million into the budget this year for the attorney general to fight against some of President Trump's policies. You know, we're already seeing that with the state suing to block Trump's move to end birthright citizenship.
Right.
And, you know, just because the funds have been allocated to the state from the federal government, like things like the Inflation Reduction Act, that doesn't mean that President Trump could try to take some of those funds back, and the state would then have to sue to get those funds actually released to them. House Speaker Nadine Nakamura says that, you know, that's one of the big unknowns that the legislature will have to continue to work through this session.
The new federal administration coming in and the impacts that we will be feeling here in Hawaii are beyond our control. So there are certain things that we are going to have to figure out as we go through this session, as more information becomes available to us about, for example, federal cuts in programs, obligations, federal obligations that may not be coming through here because of executive orders signed the other day. For example, we have to be nimble. We have to be able to address some of these concerns.
Yeah, and if things like the Inflation Reduction Act funding for energy and transportation projects are cut, or services like Medicaid are cut, you know, Representative Yamashita says that there are going to be really tough choices down the road if those things do come to fruition. But Governor Green did commit to funding Planned Parenthood if their federal funds are cut, which they were last time that Trump was in office. And he also committed to funding homeless programs and cuts to Medicaid. He committed to, you know, using state funds to backfill that if those cuts come to fruition.
Right. And then I know they were talking about maybe using some of that rainy day fund to offset the insurance, condo insurance issues. But yeah we'll just
so
see what they come up with.
Exactly. And I think there's another fund called the Hurricane Relief Fund. And that's kind of the fund that they're looking at as possibly using to address the insurance problem. There's like a whole board of there's a board that's kind of deciding that has public meetings, and they're trying to consult right now with how an insurance like that would, in fact, be set up using that hurricane fund that has been previously used as just kind of like the state's reserves in addition mm-hmm. to the rainy day fund.
Yeah, so lots of options depending on what the feds do, right?
Right, exactly. And I think that's kind of been something, a reason why, you know, that the rainy day fund is so precious to the legislature, because they are concerned about not just federal funding, but also what's going to happen with the Maui lawsuit or for the fire victims that are awaiting the Supreme Court's ruling.
Right. Well, yeah. Lots to hear on before we can make some decisions. But thank you so much, Ashley.
Yeah. Thank you.
We've been hearing from HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizzou. Look for her stories on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
President Trump made a campaign promise to end wars, starting with Ukraine. Now he has a Secretary of State in place to carry out that agenda.
There will have to be concessions made by the Russian Federation, but also by the Ukrainians.
What Trump's cabinet picks tell us about his plans for Ukraine. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Nairit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna with supportive housing, such as the Institute for Human Services. NairitHawaii.com.
A Spanish language album is topping the charts this week. The Puerto Rican rapper and singer Bad Bunny released the new album featuring a song with a prominent reference to Hawaii. The song's title translates to "What Happened in Hawaii," and the lyrics compare issues like the displacement of locals and overtourism between the two islands. Rudy Guevara Jr. is a professor of Asian Pacific American Studies at Arizona State University, and he's the author of Aloha Compadre, A History of Latinos in Hawaii. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about his reaction to the song.
I was surprised, not surprised, but also very thrilled that this song came out because it's really speaking to these larger conversations that we're having and why I did the book in terms of like how certain groups have been impacted by white supremacy, colonialism, imperialism, and all these sort of things, and sort of what does that look like in these conversations between folks that have been or their histories of colonization. And so I think this was a really good way, and I think music's an excellent way to disseminate this kind of information because it reaches a much wider audience than books, you know, and articles. And it's a great song, and hopefully there's more of these types of songs that come out to sort of inform what's going on and to just sort of give us a reminder of our past and cautionary tales of how we can be better and do better.
And when you dissect a song, I feel like there are so many places where you can dive in, whether it is the lyrics or the melody or even the style it's modeled after. But I mean, we can just start with the title, Lo que le pasó a Hawaii.
Lo que le pasó a Hawaii, like, you know, so what happened in Hawaii. So I think, yeah, it's a good translation of sort of what the song is about and being sung from the perspective of a Puerto Rican. I think that's important to see that and to bring those two connecting threads of history together, I think is genius in many ways. To have this was, I think, really a song of validation also in many ways to put out what's been happening, what's continuing to happen, and what do we do or where do we go.
Is it fair to say the main message is don't let what happened to Hawaii happen to Puerto Rico?
Yes, definitely. With regards to tourism, gentrification, further colonization, militarization, all these sort of things, I think it's those are the sort of messages and sort of how when people leave, how sometimes they can't come back. And that's been the story for many migrants that have gone abroad, you know, and what does that mean for the people who stayed and those conversations? So I think it's a really great way to sort of set that all up and sort of see, because Puerto Ricans were a part of Hawaii's history and continue to be, but, you know, starting in the at the turn of the 20th century. So it's, you know, there's a long presence there.
When I look at the lyrics, there are kind of these two different but connected forces that he's talking about. One is out-migration of people leaving, the place not being the same. But then there's also others. I mean, I think it's implied Americans coming in and taking the river and the beach and the natural beauty. Can we define those two forces and how are they related?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're looking at really a history of colonialism and, you know, the U.S.'s imperial ambitions ever since coming to this continent. And then, you know, from the Indian Wars all the way to Mexico and then venture out into the Pacific and Caribbean. And I think that history of conquest and colonization has really affected many peoples and Puerto Ricans among them. And I think that that is tied into, you know, sort of this modern day colonialism and this idea of corporations coming in and taking over and buying large swaths of land and, you know, and then people of means and wealth coming in and buying up properties or second properties and, you know, sort of gentrifying the community in a way that it keeps pushing people out. So people are continually being dispossessed of their land, dislocated, displaced in many ways. And, you know, these forces continue to happen. And I think him speaking about Hawaii is really where you see this really take shape. And then it's happened to Puerto Rico also to a lesser extent, but it could be to the extent that it happened in Hawaii. And I think that is sort of his thing, is to, for people to see that in Puerto Rico, but also Puerto Ricans in the diaspora, that this is what's going on. And, you know, we need to sort of remember.
Is this song about statehood? And where does the question of statehood come in here? Because Puerto Rico is still in this middle ground. And there has been a statehood movement, I believe, for quite some time now.
Yeah, but, you know, also independence movement. You know, just sort of there's these competing perspectives of where Puerto Rico should go. There's those that see the benefits of statehood in Puerto Rico. Others who see the benefits of independence and somewhere in between. And so, but I think this is the part of sovereignty. You let people decide for themselves where they want their country to go. You don't dictate or create economic or political means to influence that in ways that disempower the people themselves in that process, and particularly the indigenous peoples and locals that are part of that.
When he sings at the end, "Quieren quitarme el río y también la playa."
Quieren quitarme el río y también la playa. Quieren el barrio mío y que tus hijos se vayan. No, no, suelte la bandera. Me olvide el alaray. Que no quiero que hagan contigo lo que te pasó.
Who's like the they when he's saying they want to take my river and beach and make my sons or like descendants leave the barrio?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're looking at it from today's perspective and how he's, if he's speaking about it, if he's speaking about it and you know, today, I mean, you're looking at the American transplants and in particular white American transplants and those that are coming in with wealth and means to buy up all of that and to push people out. Because I know that, you know, the gentrification is really changing various parts of Puerto Rico, and then not for the better in many ways. And so it's sort of one of these things where some of the same things that you see happening in Hawaii are happening in Puerto Rico now. And a lot of people have moved there who have means and wealth, while those who, you know, for example, were affected by the hurricanes, many, you know, stayed, but many also left. And then that void, people with means come in and then take over and then raise the prices of property and land value, you know, all this stuff. And so that creates the situation where you see that. And I think that that's one of the things, is that when he's saying they, it's, you know, they in terms of the means of those that are part of these colonizing structures and then participate in capitalism in those ways that push people out.
That was Rudy Guevara Jr., author of the book Aloha Compadre. He was talking about the history of Latinos in Hawaii. He was talking to HPR's Maddie Bender about a new hit song by the musical artist Bad Bunny, which features Hawaii as a cautionary tale of commercialization. We'll be back with more of that interview after a short break.
Mm-hmm.
Let's return to our conversation with ASU professor Rudy Guevara Jr. He wrote a book about the history of Latinos in Hawaii, and he spoke with the conversation's Maddie Bender about how that history explains some of the buzz around a new song by the artist Bad Bunny.
This is something that I think is maybe one of the reasons why this song has resonated in a particular way with people living here and folks on social media, is also that there is overlap. There is this history of Puerto Ricans in Hawaii. So what is kind of the history of Puerto Ricans coming to Hawaii and what their experience has been like?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, it really starts at the turn of the century. I believe it was 1901 with the San Ciriaco hurricane that devastates Puerto Rico at the time. And leaves many folks without work, without homes, you know, in very, again, very dire situations. And on the other side in Hawaii, you have the Hawaiian Sugar Planters Association, who set up this plantation economy for sugarcane, and they need workers. And so they turn to Puerto Rico and for laborers, but also, you know, in many ways to take advantage of the situation that they, because they're both territories of the United States, they can bring, circulate, again, these laborers through empire and sort of bring them into these other locations. And so the largest wave was over 5,000 individuals that came, and they came to work in the various sugar plantations and then pineapple to a lesser extent. The HSPA promises many things, but then it doesn't really like come through for the Puerto Rican migrants that initially came. And so they're treated horribly to the extent that many of them basically deserted when they came to the continental United States. Some left through New Orleans, a bunch deserted in California, and that's where you get the origins of California's Puerto Rican population. And it's because of the mistreatment and being treated without dignity and respect, even though they were coming to do this hard labor that nobody wants to do. And because they resisted and fought back and they weren't going to stand by idly, they were seen as troublemakers. And so then you get the racist stereotypes put upon Puerto Ricans in very unfair ways. And so this creates some issues early in the early 20th century, but then they're also one of many other racial and ethnic groups. And so they start, just to give the very short version, you know, they're sort of put together and there's tensions at first, but over time, a lot of these different racial and ethnic groups that are sort of put together come together in ways through food and community and sort of creating a local identity and culture all their own in Hawaii, and Puerto Ricans have been a part of that. And so, you know, within these plantation communities, you know, you have everybody racially intermixing at some point. Because of that, I think in Hawaii, Puerto Ricans are the most mixed Latinx group in Hawaii because they have all these generations of intermixing, and many of them go back multiple generations of mixing. And, you know, I think one of the things too is that because of the way they were treated, they wrote letters back home saying, don't come, this is what they're doing. And so there was a huge dip in more migrants coming over time, but then also many Puerto Ricans couldn't go back home. They couldn't afford it, and they just were stuck. But they made the community and the life that they had with other Puerto Ricans in Hawaii, but also their, you know, through all the intermarriages and community, the larger community that they became a part of with Native Hawaiians and other locals. So I think that's something that is still what you see still resonating today. And I think one of the things too, because both Puerto Rico and Hawaii were highly militarized. You know, one of the things as activists and those that are tied to the, you know, La Tierra or the Aina is these moments when, you know, the U.S. military was bombing both Kahoolawe and Vieques Island. And so they see the connection for Native Hawaiians that are indigenous and for Puerto Ricans that are of indigenous descent and many that are indigenous, you know, you just see, they see the connections and a lot of the sovereignty movements and a lot of the cultural movements that are occurring and many overlaps and coalitions between the two supporting each other. It's because they saw, you know, as being part of under U.S. imperialism, seeing how both places or sites were treated, how its people were treated, how the land was treated, the water, the air, everything. And so I think that's where you see these connections and ultimately where you see a song like Bad Bunny's coming out of is that history and that sort of collaboration and understanding and sort of working together and also recognizing each other in that same struggle.
I know we only just brushed the surface, but is there anything else you want to add? And thinking about a listener, is there anything you think they should take away from this interview or think next time they're listening to Bad Bunny on the radio.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's oftentimes, you know, when we listen to music, we love the beat and we don't always pay close attention to the lyrics, particularly if you don't speak the language. And I think with social media now and technology, you can easily translate a song and get the English translation. But it also has a certain meaning to it when it's spoken in Spanish. And so, like, I think, you know, one of the things is to, like, enjoy the music, but listen to the message, too, because the message through this beautiful music, a powerful message is being shared, and to understand it and to take the time to understand why certain messages are being conveyed. What is the history behind it? And just being, I would say, just to be curious about that and to look into these things, because, you know, Puerto Ricans are one group of many different Latinx groups that have come to Hawaii and been a part of Hawaii's history and call Hawaii home. And that's a whole nother conversation. But I think it's like finding solutions to these various issues. It's also a lesson on how to be a better human being and seeing each other's humanity. And in doing so, you can understand the plight of folks and want to do your part so that there aren't these repeats of history and circumstances that happen in places, that those things can be minimized, if not eliminated, over time. And music is a wonderful vehicle to do that with. And so I think that, you know, I look forward to hearing more songs of this nature, because not only does it sound good, but it also has a meaningful message.
We've been hearing from Rudy Guevara Jr., professor of Asian Pacific American Studies at Arizona State University. He's also the author of Aloha Compadre. He spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender about the history of Puerto Ricans in Hawaii, giving us context to a hit new song by the musical artist Bad Bunny.
Support for HPR comes from BIA Hawaii's Big Home Building and Remodeling Show this Friday through Sunday, featuring home building seminars, exhibitors, and products. More at homeshowhawaii.com.
African history is often reduced to colonialism, conquest, and war. Lesser known are Africa's great historical triumphs, such as the ancient kingdom of Kush.
It gave rise to 1,000 pyramids, beautiful pottery, jewelry, ceramics. It's not known about, despite the fact that everybody knows about ancient Egypt, and it's right next to it.
An African's history of Africa. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
You know, we heard from several of our listeners following our recent interview with Heather Juni and Noel Kahanu. They are co-producers of the film Under a Jarvis Moon, which tells the story of the Hui of Panalaau, a group of mostly Native Hawaiian young men who helped secure control over a number of remote Pacific islands for the U.S. in the 1930s. The group, which included Kahanu's grandfather, was posthumously honored by President Joe Biden in the last week of his presidency. We received this note from David Dewey from Waikoloa following our show. He writes, I was in the Coast Guard on the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Plane Tree in 1969 and 1970 and visited those islands to satisfy international law by doing maintenance on the coral beacons on each island. None of us knew a thing about this history, and when we were there, no signs of anyone ever being there was visible. Thank you for reporting on remembrance, and I only wish that the island's history was more widely known then. We also visited Christmas Island then too, Kiribati now I think, and never knew that the British did an above-ground nuclear test south of the island. Thanks for the wonderful story. We also heard from Quinn, who tells us her granduncle was on Holland Island during these occupations, and she ended up learning some more family history thanks to hearing the segment and watching the documentary. We do appreciate your feedback. If you have thoughts to share, call our TalkBack line and leave a voicemail, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Twenty 2025 officially kicks off as the year of our community forests, and we've been highlighting stories about what it takes to feed our islands. We've heard from the National Tropical Botanical Garden as well as the Ulu Cooperative. Well, the conversation's Maddie Bender wanted to learn more about the experience of local farmers. She recently sat down with Melissa Danielle. Danielle has been working in food systems for some 20 years and moved to Hawaii to Oahu during the pandemic. That's when she decided to get back to basics as a grower.
So during that time, it's like, I'm just going to start a garden. I'm just going to start growing. And then I was just like, I really want to get back into food, into community food. And I realized that the way for me to get back into it was to actually start farming, because it looked very different here than what I was used to in New York City.
So what has your farming practice looked like here? And you also shared that you're a student still. You're taking classes.
Yeah. So I recently completed Go Farm in Waimanalo and Go Fish also in Waimanalo. So that's the Go Fish is the aquaponics, commercial aquaponics training. And I just felt like I needed more immersion. And so I have been taking classes in CTAR. I'm enrolled now at UH West Oahu in the Sustainable Community Food Systems, just because I felt like I wanted more of the conversation. You know, you can get into a kind of silo doing your thing, you know, and as a farmer, it's like, I grow food. This is what's impacting me as a farmer. And then as an eater, I have to buy food, or I have to get it some kind of way. This is what's impacting me as an eater. And then you have the people in between, you know, the producers, the added value producers, the chefs, the restaurant owners, the grocery store owners, and then they have all their impacts. And I've always just been interested in building those relationships, because I think, or at least what I have learned, is that we don't know the true cost of food. And because we don't know the true cost of food, we don't value it as much, and we don't understand how quickly we could lose access to it.
What, if anything, do you plan for yourself this year? So thinking about timeline when it comes to growing and producing food, but also your class schedule and thinking about transferring some of these learned skills into action, into teaching others or working as a farmer.
Okay, so I discovered pretty early on in Go Farm that I was not interested in fighting with the bugs and the weeds. And so I quickly decided that I would be focused on aquaculture. And so what I am actually looking at is I'm starting an aeroponic tower farm. So I'm vertically planting and I'm outside. So I still want to have this relationship with being outside. And I still actually compost, and I add compost tea to my nutrients. And so what I'm actually looking at building is a CSA-based UPIC. So I'm going to be growing a diversified vegetable operation, but I'm going to allow the members to pick what they want. And so now they have to have a relationship with me. You know, they're going to have to book a time. They're going to have to come physically to the farm. They get to see the operation. They get to ask me questions. They get to see the crops in various stages, you know, from seedling to harvest to that's going back to seed now because we didn't pick it, right? And so that's the relationship that I want to cultivate. My other thing is that I feel, so to borrow a movement, we need to be growing food, not lawns. And especially where I live in Kailua, there is like so much underutilized green space. And I see people, you know, they're spending a couple hundred dollars a month to keep these lawns manicured that they don't even sit outside and enjoy. And I'm like, you could be giving me that money to manage a garden for you. And then all you have to do is step outside and pick what you want. So that's also something that I'm exploring.
What does your aquaponics system look like now? Like, what's the timeline on being able to have people come and pick their own produce?
So right now, it'll just be the aeroponics. And aeroponics is basically, so in hydroponic systems, there are several ways to grow plants in water. You can have what's called a deep water culture where the roots are constantly in, they're in a water bath. You can have a flow of running water, and you can have the roots misted. So aeroponics is basically the roots are suspended in air and the roots are misted on a continuous basis with water. And so that's the system that I use, and that's what I'm going to get started with. So I have about 20 towers, and I'm going to do a pilot with about 10 or so members, like 10 members for 10 weeks, 10 weeks on, 2-3 weeks off, 10 weeks on, so that I can get feedback from them and we can figure out like how many members, how many families can I support?
Yeah. And then, 20 towers, how many, you know, individual slots for?
About, it's 50-something.
Per tower?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you can get a lot. You can definitely grow a lot.
Do you have any advice for people who hear this and feel inspired to get into growing more or even to deepen their relationships with local farmers and growers?
My advice would be to grow something. I think that people get really overwhelmed with this idea that they have to have this really huge, robust garden. And really, you could just grow herbs. You can just start with the one thing that you eat a lot of. And so herbs are relatively easy to maintain and neglect to, you know, to a degree. But then it's like, if you love tomatoes, grow your own tomatoes. If you want to eat a salad every day, just get you some different greens and just experiment with that. I'm not expecting anybody to replace what they buy from the grocery store. But if you grow one thing and you have a relationship with that one thing that you grow, it will have a tremendous impact on your relationship with food. And the other thing is to get involved. So I would say join Hawaii Farmers Union, host some potlucks in your neighborhood with your family and friends and talk about the food system and what you might, you know, want to see differently. Take a look at the bills that are currently on the table in this session, in this legislative session. Call your rep and your senator and ask them what agricultural bills are they supporting this session, and share your opinion about it. Tell them what you want to see, you know? And so that's grow food, grow so much that you have to give it away.
And that was local farmer Melissa Danielle talking with HR's Maddie Bender. We'll have links to some of the resources that she mentions on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is a conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. And for this week's Manu Minute, we've got the mating song of the rock pigeon, which was introduced to Hawaii more than 200 years ago, thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology for these recordings. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Rock pigeons, also known as pigeons, are common throughout Hawaii and are one of the world's best-known birds. Their appearance has been altered by centuries of domestication, but they usually range from light to dark blue-gray, with patches of iridescent purple, blue, or green colors on their feathers. Males and females look the same, but males often have more of the iridescence on their neck, which is caused by the way light is reflected off their feathers, not by any particular feather pigments. Rock pigeons feed mainly on grass seeds, grain, and various food scraps in cities and urban areas. Their primary song is a display coo, which they use to attract their mates and is accompanied by a puffing up of their throat feathers and a series of courtship bows. Certain breeds of pigeons, known as homing or carrier pigeons, have a well-known ability to bring rolled-up messages written on paper back to their home from distant places they've never been. Rock pigeons are native to North Africa and Asia and were first brought to Hawaii in the late 1700s, making them one of our first introduced non-native birds. There have been many introductions since, including those ubiquitous white pigeons found around Waikiki, which may be descendants of birds brought from Canada for the dedication of Kapi'olani Bird Park by King Kalakaua in 1874. While pigeons are loved around the world as pets and also food, their large numbers can make them a public nuisance. Here in Hawaii, they may also be competing with native seabirds such as Noyo for hard-to-find nesting sites along sea cliffs. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society. For more than 8 decades, fostering community values that work to protect Hawaii's native wildlife and ecosystems. Learn more about membership and other ways to help at hiaudubon.org.
The latest eruption at Kilauea Summit has been paused since Saturday, but a new play explores how an impending volcanic eruption can strain family relationships and reveal a generational divide. Southernmost opens at Kumukuhua Theater in Honolulu tomorrow night. It focuses on a local family living in Kau on the southern end of the Big Island. Sparks fly when daughter Charlene returns home after a long absence and her father Wally is confronted with how much she has changed. That tension plays out as a volcanic eruption threatens the family home. HPR's Russell Subiano sat down with retired attorney and veteran actor Alan Okubo, who plays Wally in the production.
I kind of get the impression that some of the themes that the play explores are the differences between generations and adjusting to change. Hmm. And so what are your thoughts on how the play approaches those themes?
Well, it's, you know, like with the younger generation, Hawaii is an isolated rock. And, you know, they get so used to, you know, there's nothing to do. So they want to go to explore the world. So same thing with Charlene. She went to the mainland, met people over there, came out of her shell and became, you know, what she is or wanted to be. And when she comes back, she's now Hawaiian. You know, she talks like she's from there. Her pidgin is pretty much not pronounced, even though me and Bruce and we're all, you know, talking pure pidgin. And when she comes back, it sneaks out every once in a while in her sentences. But, you know, she wants to be a grown up living in the big world and doing all these things like that. And I'm trying to convince her that, you know, this is the perfect place. You know, you've got the land, you've got the sky, you've got nature, you know, you got all this beauty. And why you want to put yourself in this crowded city with all these people running around? So that's where our heads butt. There's that friction going on back and forth. But it's different for this generation. I really feel sorry for them because I can see why people want to leave because the cost of living and everything is going up. And I look at the price of land and all that, I'm thinking, gee, how are my grandkids going to be able to survive? You know, because it's ridiculous what's happening. I don't know if it's ever going to come down. You know, usually things go up, it never comes down. So it's scary, you know.
From what I've read about the play, is the other sort of main character in the story are the earthquakes and the impending eruption that many folks in the Kau district on the Big Island, they feel these earthquakes on a regular basis, and it's a real concern for them. Yeah. Should Mauna Loa erupt or should Kilauea erupt in a rift zone? I felt like it was an interesting choice for the writer to have that be another factor in how the characters have to relate to each other. Can you talk about how the earthquakes and the eruption, how they impact the story?
With now the news, the way the, you know, there's The last I saw a report that said ash is coming down into Kau District, which is, you know, pretty much what's happening in the play, that, you know, they've got this farm and it's peaceful for the most part. And then all of a sudden there's this earthquakes, and then you can see this lava glow in the background, you know, and it's getting bigger and bigger as the play goes along, to the point that, you know, it's, you got to evacuate because it's coming. I don't want to leave. This is my sanctuary. This is my home. And I fight tooth and nail to stay there until it's the last minute. It gets to the point, you know, and I'm begging Pele, you know, don't do this. It's our land. And then the ending is I'm worried about my daughter because she's helping me pick coffee, even though the lava's coming, and I'm trying to get her out of there. And now I'm begging Pele not so much for the land, but save my daughter, you know. So, and there's a shift in that, you know. So, but it's really a play. It's a love story in many directions. Love story about the land. Love story about taking care of legends like Pele and all that. And the love story within the family, even though it's fractured, but it's still there. It's just kind of not fused together tightly as it was before. Even, and I guess even when it, before, we were still bucking heads, but, you know, it was still a family. It's like a normal family. Yeah. Everybody, not everybody is all, you know, copacetic.
You've been an actor in the local theater community for a long time. I know that you've also been on the original 5-0, the original Magnum PI. I know that you had a role in the new Hawaii 5-0 as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you love about acting?
See, when I put it this way, I couldn't even stand up in front of a class to tell, you know, we had a book report. I mean, I couldn't do it. I mean, it was just totally frightening. And then I took an acting class at UH. The only reason I took it, because I needed another 3-credit class. And I literally went through the whole UH book looking for, you know, an easy 3-credit class. And I came across beginning acting, and it said, no exams, no papers. So I called them up and I said, is this true? No exams, no papers. They said, yes. I says, okay, sign me up. So I went there, and then Glenn Cannon was the professor. And first day of class, we went through this, you know, stuff, introductory and all that. And then he said, okay, next class, everybody has to sing a song. And I went home and I went, do I quit now, or how do I get out of this without, you know, totally, you know, bombing? And because just talking was a problem, you know, in front of people. I'm thinking, you know, singing is even worse because you got to hit the notes. So what I did was I went through my old records, you know, the old 78s and all 33s. I found this Eddie Cantor song, Little Curly Hair in a High Chair.
Little curly hair in a high chair. What's your orders for today? Little curly hair in a high chair. I'll do anything you say.
And I'm listening to that, I'm thinking, I might be able to do this one. And if I sing it as a baby, I won't have to hit all the notes. So I got up there and I sang it as a baby. And when I finished and I saw Glenn laughing, I said, okay, maybe I'll survive the class.
So acting helped you to overcome your fear of public speaking?
I tell people, and, you know, like if I go to classes and I tell students, you know, career days and all that, when you're acting, and even if you have a fear of, you know, speaking, when you're doing a play or whatever, it's not you that's making a fool of yourself. It's the character. So, you know, it's not like me personally just being an idiot. It's not me that, you know, looks funny. It's the character I'm playing that is mean or happy or stupid or whatever. So, it, you know, it takes me out of me, and, you know, I can overcome talking to people. And after a while, it got easier and easier. And, you know, now I can talk to people without going.
I know that you've also been an attorney for a long time, for several decades. Does being an attorney inform your acting and vice versa? Does acting make you a better attorney? Does being an attorney make you a better actor?
I think it was a combination, because I had to put my acting into the being an attorney, because, again, it's public speaking.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're talking in front of people in, you know, a courtroom and a judge and all that. And if it was the old days, I would have been tongue-tied.
Yeah.
So when I was doing cases, I'm acting as a lawyer, so that I could just, you know, ease my way through all this thing. So it worked both ways, you know. And being an attorney helped me navigate being an actor in certain instances.
Can you share details about Southernmost?
Southernmost takes place in Kau, and the name Southernmost is significant because, and I used to bet people drinks, says, what is the southernmost city in the United States? And they all picked someplace in Florida. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, Na'alehu, which is the southernmost, you know, and so Kau district is the southernmost point in the United States geographically, you know. So it takes place there. And I play Wally Chavez, and Becky Chavez, who is my wife, is played by Sanai Tokumura. Mm-hmm. My daughter, Charlene, she's played by Ember Isabello. And Jessica Coleman, her girlfriend, is played by Violet Skilling. And my neighbor, Bruce Canijo, is played by Stu Hirayama. The play is written by Mary Lyon Kamitaki. And I think she's originally from the Big Island, now living in New York. And she'll be coming back on the second week of the play to see the play and have a talk back. And the director is Harry Wong III. We open January 23rd. We run to February 23rd. Thursday through Saturday, it's 7 o'clock shows. Sunday, 2 o'clock matinees. And Super Bowl, there is no show. So we've got a matinee on February 8th, Saturday.
Okay.
So there's a 2 o'clock matinee on that day. So there's a doubleheader on that day.
Alan Okubo plays Wally Chavez in Southernmost, which opens at Kumukahua Theater this Thursday, January 23rd. Alan, thanks so much for coming to the station, man. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
That was local actor Alan Okubo talking with HPR's Russell Subiono about a play called Southernmost. It opens tomorrow night at Kumukahua Theater, whose mission is to showcase Hawaii stories. Look for links on our website after the show. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to check in with a homegrown opera star whose Met performance will be shown in theaters statewide. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our shows online on our website, or we're available as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.